Welcome to Phone Sex with Lily Show, where talent in front and behind the camera is showcased and explored. As you can imagine, there are a lot of characters and personalities in this industry. Listen as they share their stories. But first, grab your lube and get comfortable because the guests will unknowingly be subjected to phone sex with a porn star, webcam model, and your host, Lily Craven.
Hello.
Hi. What are you doing today?
Oh, I'm just laying here reading a book. I didn't really feel like getting out of bed today.
Are you going through a breakup as well?
Well, recently, I had to let go of a partner who just wasn't meeting my sexual needs.
I hate when that happens. Mine was meeting everybody's needs but mine.
Oh, girl, tell me about it. I've gotten really good at meeting my own needs.
Yeah, that's a whole different subject. You know, at least we won't catch any of those STD things from doing ourselves.
Well, I like my toys and I'm very good with my hands.
Me too. And you know, I can take really, really big toys.
You can. Tell me more.
Yes. Well, it was raining one day and I just said, what the heck? And I went and got a can of soda and just put it in.
Girl, really? What did that feel like? Was it warm or was it cold?
It was cold and it just went in and I'm like, I had no idea.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to get it back out again. Did you replace it with a different kind of toy after that? Something softer maybe?
Well, a little bit harder. It was a beer bottle. You're watching Phone Sex with Lily Show. Hello, my goodness. I have a very, very special guest today. This is a topic that I've been trying to touch upon for a long time. I think it's so needed in our industry. It is. Please introduce yourself because I don't want to slaughter it.
That's okay.
Our special guest today.
I'm Dr. Amber Hall. I am a private practice physician here in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I specialize both in pediatrics and in sexual health and wellness.
Woo! Hail to you. So, man, well, thanks for coming to chat with us because I think that we have a huge problem in our industry of testing. And it's not necessarily the testing, but we don't know what we're testing for or why it costs what it does. We just do it because we're told to.
Right. So thank you so much for having me on the show today. I've really been looking forward to this conversation and answering any questions that you have. And I'll start off by saying that the industry is not unique in not knowing what a full panel, quote unquote, test is composed of, or why we test for certain things and not for others, and why industry folks are subjected to additional tests that aren't typically ordered in the sort of civilian world. There's a lot of confusion about it, and I get into a lot of conversations both with the public, with folks who are engaged with me through Artemis Luxury Wellness, from industry folks, and I'll do my best to answer any questions that you have, and I'll be honest about things when I don't know the answer.
Well, thank you very much for that. So let's get started with what exactly is our gold panel or our adult talent panel that we test for? What is on that?
So off the top of my head, industry folks do three different tests for HIV. So there's an antibody test, an antigen test, and there is also an early detection test, which is either an HIV-1 RNA-PCR or a DNA test. Gonorrhea, chlamydia, trichomonas, syphilis. I feel like I'm back in medical school going for a board exam.
You're doing great. Ones?
Mycoplasma genitalium. Hepatitis B and C. We don't routinely, either on an industry panel or in the civilian world, test for hepatitis A. And syphilis. Syphilis, I said, yes. I think that's it. HIV, Hep A, Hep, or I'm sorry, HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, trichomonas, mycoplasma genitalium. And there's throat swabs and rectal swabs. And the brothel workers, at least here in Nevada, have to undergo vaginal swabs as well, as opposed to just a urine test, which is sort of what would happen out in the civilian world.
Okay, so we used to take a urine test. That was for the chlamydia and gonorrhea. Mm-hmm. And then they switched it up. Well, they didn't switch it. They added the swabs. Mm-hmm. And true or false, do you have to be someone who has anal sex to get anal swabbed?
Do you have to be? So yeah. People who are not receiving anal penetration are much less likely to get infected in that area. I'm not sure if that's the question that you're asking.
Because I was told that the anal swabs were for almost like accuracy, like a baby's temperature. You would do a rectal thermometer, and that it's more accurate. And you don't have to be someone who has anal sex to get that test. That's why we all have to do the test, regardless if we have anal sex or not.
Right. So there are a couple of answers to this question, just from a scientific and like a clinical standpoint that would... You know, and I'm trying to answer this theoretically because I wasn't in the discussion surrounding what tests were ordered and why, but just thinking through it clinically, I know that vaginal swabs are more sensitive than a urine test. So the urine test generally, in the civilian population or in the industry population, gonorrhea, chlamydia, trichomonas. Urine test, a vaginal test will pick up infection that a urine test will sometimes miss. That missed test would be called a false negative. So vaginal swab is more sensitive. For I would think like gonorrhea, chlamydia, there's like a theoretical risk that the organism can migrate down the perineum sort of either from the vaginal area or from like the scrotum, the penis, the taint, if you will, like that the organisms could migrate and then get into the rectal cavity, theoretically. And that would be why rectal swabs would be required, even if someone denied having had receptive anal penetration.
So you were talking about the anal swabs. And so we were saying, do you need to be someone who participates in anal sex for that to be a test worthy of taking?
So there are a couple of different reasons why I think that this would be indicated. First of all, one of the first things that we learn in medicine is that a lot of times patients don't tell the entire truth. So someone can deny having receptive anal penetration, and that doesn't mean that they are not receiving anal penetration. And when you have a population who is like at higher risk, then it just makes sense to make a rule across the board. Everybody's getting tested because we don't know who's telling the truth and who is withholding. The other sort of factor that comes into play is that there's a theoretical risk that an infectious organism like gonorrhea, chlamydia, trichomonas could migrate down the perineum or like the taint in, you know, layman's terms, migrate from the vaginal or penile area down into the perianal area. And therefore you could pick up an infection in that region even if someone is not receiving anal penetration. Does that make sense?
Gosh, that makes sense. And I think there was someone who, I knew someone who was clean on their urine, but then their anal swab, they got a dirt, you know, they got a positive. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, but I don't have anal sex. I don't understand why. And I was just grateful because I was going to film with them. I was grateful that they made us do these swabs all of a sudden. So I've been an advocate of that, but we really don't quite know why we take that. Like what right. it is.
Well, in the context of another clinical scenario, my background is in, you know, pediatrics and in women's health. And when we're testing for group B strep, which can be a very significant infection and cause big problems in the neonate, we usually test pregnant people both vaginally and rectally for group B strep, because the risk of infection in the neonate is so high, we want to make sure that we pick it up in either of those places. And we do that test regardless of, we don't even ask women if they're having receptive anal penetration. We just swab both areas because the risk is so high to the newborn.
Gotcha. Yes. And we tend to sometimes not tell the truth about those kind of sensitive subjects. So that makes sense. So now we just had the MGen test added to our panel, which we found out it was only PASS, I believe, that is advocating for it.
So it's my understanding, and again, I wasn't in the room when the decisions were made about what would be included, but it's my understanding that there was an outbreak within the industry, a pretty substantial outbreak of pelvic inflammatory disease. And I did actually a lot of reading on this to prepare for this question, because the historically, the main organisms, culprit organisms resulting in pelvic inflammatory disease are chlamydia and gonorrhea. But there are a number of other different organisms that can cause that. And when I say pelvic inflammatory disease, this is an infection that sort of migrates up through the vaginal canal and can infect the fallopian tubes, the ovaries, even kind of like get into the endometrium of the uterus, and it can cause vomiting and fever and chills. Like women and people with uteruses have to be hospitalized. Like it can cause systemic sepsis. And it often goes undetected because the symptoms can be sort of vague, like, oh, I have lower abdominal pain and, you know, I have a fever and I don't feel well and I'm vomiting. And it's an infection that can be overlooked, but that has the potential to cause really serious hospitalization and death types of manifestations. And so it's my understanding that there was an outbreak of pelvic inflammatory disease within the adult industry, and the typical, you know, usual suspect organisms were all coming up negative. And then someone thought to test for Mycoplasma genitalium, and that ended up being the, you know, the organism that was causing problems in all of these different performers. And so the decision was then made, my understanding, I'm here, like this is secondhand knowledge, that the decision was made to add that organism to the testing panel. In the, you know, just the civilian world, the lay population, I never have ordered a test for Mycoplasma genitalium on a patient under any clinical circumstances. And I've worked in like ICUs and emergency departments and women's health clinics and pediatrics offices. Like I've taken care of a ton of patients with sexually transmitted infections. Never have I ever tested for Mycoplasma genitalium because I've never had a reason to. But that's my understanding as to why it's done on this specific panel. Now, why it's done, you know, why PASS is requiring it, and, you know, some of the other clearing testing organizations are not, I don't have an answer to those questions.
Yeah, I think that somewhere along the line, they were no longer standing together as one on some subjects, from my understanding. So they have a little bit of a divide. Mm-hmm. But that actually makes sense. I would just think that we're being, like, that test was not, I mean, you could probably do, if someone has pelvic inflammatory disease, there would be a whole array of stuff you would test before that. And like you said, that it wasn't coming up, they were all negative. So then if someone actually tested for that, it would make sense. But to have us all take it, because isn't it somewhat common for it to be in your body, but not necessarily at a, like it can either go up or down, or it can go away on its own. It's what your body does with it. Like you can be asymptomatic and not have any issues.
Correct. So there are a number of organisms that are sort of like the resident flora in the genital tract of a healthy vagina, right? Gardnerella is one of them, ureaplasma, Mycoplasma genitalium. There can be small amounts of like resident yeast. And as long as they're not overgrowing, then, you know, they're just sort of like the friendly resident, like our gut bacteria. They keep things healthy and normal. It's when there's an overgrowth, like BV is incredibly common. And that it results from a change in the pH of the vaginal canal that allows an overgrowth of certain organisms. And then, you know, you end up being treated. But you're right. Like some people will, just like some people clear HPV without ever even knowing that they had it, right? Like some people can have and clear Mycoplasma genitalium or ureaplasma. You know, a lot of times Gardnerella doesn't become an issue in the absence of pH changes. So you're correct that it can be part of the vaginal flora and never cause, you know, symptoms of infection.
Because I get concerned. I mean, we all know that as Americans, I don't know if it's just America, but we tend to jump into antibiotics quickly. It's here, take this for this. Here's more antibiotics. And, you know, and that's not a good thing to be. It's making it more and more difficult to treat things. So to put a bunch of people on antibiotics just because mm-hmm. there are issues, it just seems like we would know like someone who's having these significant problems, but maybe not. Like it just makes me wonder, like, how big of a problem is this? Like, is it that big that we need to do, you know, and medicate ourselves? Because a lot of people are popping for it. Like,
yeah. So this is where clinical decision making comes in, right? And, you know, and I share your concern. And I can tell you that from the standpoint of my medical training, and especially pediatricians, right? Like people come in, and this was ubiquitous in pediatrics clinics. Like kids come in with a viral illness and the parents are like, we want an antibiotic. He needs amoxicillin. I'm like, no, this is a virus. And an antibiotic isn't going to do anything but wreck the kid's gut, give him diarrhea, and, you know, cause other problems.
Immune to it eventually. Yes.
So pediatricians are notoriously stingy with antibiotics to the frustration of many parents, because of the exact concerns that you're raising. And I know many of my colleagues too, are not quick to put people on antibiotics, and antibiotic stewardship is something that is very much drilled into us during medical training and during residency, because I've taken care of patients who, like, you know, the normal ceftriaxone and, you know, amoxicillin and these types of things aren't working anymore. And so we have to go to these like big guns antibiotics that really are wrecking people's guts and putting them at risk for all these other things, because the things that we typically use aren't working. And I know that, you know, you're right. Antibiotic resistant gonorrhea is a thing. And, you know, I want to touch on DoxyPep and we'll get to that subject a little bit later, but to answer your question, there is some clinical decision-making that comes in, right? Like if a patient comes to me and is like, hey, you know, I popped positive on a routine screening for Mycoplasma genitalium, my question to them is like, well, do you want to wait and see if you clear it naturally? And we'll, you know, because the incubation period for MGen is 4 to 8 weeks. So if you show up at a shoot and you've got a positive MGen, you didn't get it. The likelihood is that you didn't get it last week. You got it like a month or two ago. But my question then would be like, are you here to work? Do you want to work? If you want to work, then we should treat it. But if you would rather wait and see if your body clears it naturally, then we can order another test and, you know, see if you clear it in a month or two. But for people who's, you know, paying their bills, like a roof over their head, their livelihood depends on being able to work, then the option is really like, okay, we're going to treat it. Let's do our best to protect your gut microbiome. And, you know.
Wouldn't they be out of work regardless for a month? I mean, what's the sit out time?
So the treatment course for Mycoplasma genitalium is 2 weeks.
Okay. Because I had talked to the health department in my area, and they were shocked about chlamydia, gonorrhea. We have a 7-day return. Mm-hmm. They were like, oh, no way. Like they said, it's got to be 30 days. They were just adamant about this. And I'm, you know, writing this down, and they were like getting upset. I can't believe you do it for 7 days. But, you know, a lot of different doctors say different things. But in your opinion, is 7 days enough time to shed all of, if you're positive and do the treatment for like chlamydia, is that mm-hmm. enough time to shed it all and be safe to go to work?
So this is a really good question, and it hasn't come up in my clinical practice. So again, I'm relying on my understanding of science and medicine in that, you know, gonorrhea, chlamydia, like chlamydia is treated with a one-time dose of 1,000 milligrams of azithromycin, and assuming it's not an antibiotic resistant strain. And so my approach to that would be, if I had a patient who came and was like, hey, I'm positive for this, I would treat them. And if they were a person who had a vagina, I would probably also give them an antifungal, because 1,000 milligrams of azithromycin is probably going to give them a yeast infection. Yeah. And so I would treat the patient and then probably reorder the test to ensure clearance and then send them off to work. I mean, if you treat the patient and the patient tests negative,
then, and can that happen in a week's time?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, again, like drawing on my clinical knowledge, like if I treat a kid with an ear infection, right? Like I give him a week of antibiotics, he's cleared the infection. That's it.
It's cleared, right?
Yeah.
And is there an incubation period for certain, like the period where it won't show up on a test?
It depends on
like
the organism.
Chlamydia or—
Yeah, okay. It depends on the organism. And that's why we test so frequently. I have a big, thick book of infectious diseases and all the different organisms and what their incubation periods are. I didn't look those up before this before this interview, but I'll use HIV as an example, right? And this is why industry folks get more stringent HIV testing than, you know, the general population. And it's because the antigen and antibody screen will take 30 days or more to show a positive after infection, whereas the HIV1 RNA or the DNA will actually, like, it detects viral particles that are in the bloodstream before the immune system has had a chance to respond and produce antibodies. So you can be positive for HIV early on in infection, and you'll like flag positive at 10 days on an HIV RNA PCR test, where you may not flag on an antigen antibody screen for over 30 days.
Wow. And is it true? Here's another one. Can you get HIV if you are undetected?
So undetectable viral loads of HIV are non-transmissible. And this is why, you know, there are folks like Jonathan Van Ness who are very like face out in being HIV positive and, you know, being on treatment and advocating for people who are positive, because an HIV positive person who's on like on antiretroviral therapy with an undetectable viral load is not transmissible. And their partner, especially if their partner's on PrEP, is going to be vanishingly unlikely to contract HIV, at least through sexual contact, right? And again, I'll use the pregnancy analogy too. So if you've got a pregnant patient who is HIV positive and they're, you know, talking about delivering a baby, if that patient is on like antiretroviral therapy and their viral load is less than like 50, I don't remember the units off the top of my head, but I know that the number is 50. If their like viral load is that low, they fall into a category of being low risk of transmission to the fetus. And so when the baby's born, the baby falls into a lower risk category, but we still put the baby on antiretroviral therapy for a minimum of 2 weeks that's born to an HIV positive mom.
Okay. That makes sense. Cause, and we've heard there are people who film in the industry undetected. My thoughts would be, how do we know they're taking their medication? How do you know that they're responsible? Or it's just one of those, like, because they don't necessarily disclose it. They don't disclose it to you to say that you're with someone or that particular person you're shooting with is undetected, but they'll have you sign paperwork that says that this particular studio allows undetected. Mm-hmm. So that gets scary there.
So I don't really have a position on that. I can kind of comment on your concern from a broader sort of perspective. And that is that, you know, and
more medical
with herpes, yeah. Right? Like herpes is ubiquitous in the adult population, like well over half of the adult population. Like I want to say between 60 and 80% of the adult population. If you tested for herpes simplex, one or two antibodies would test positive for those antibodies. Someone who has a history of outbreaks, whether they're oral or genital, should be disclosing, right? Like the person that you're having sex with needs to have that information so that they can make an informed decision to consent whether to play with you or not. And we don't test for HSV antibodies in the adult industry or in, you know, the civilian world. Because
everybody would have it.
Because everybody would have it, right? And like you get patients who test positive for herpes and, you know, they go into the psychological tailspin, like, you know, I'm damaged and I'm dirty and I'm awful and my sex life is over and nobody's ever going to want to like play with me or touch me or love me or and anything. And, you know, the reality of the situation is like, you know, you counsel that patient.
They haven't too. Say,
yeah. You know, like a lot of the people that you're going to want to play with probably have it too. We can put you on Valtrex. The frequency of your outbreaks is going to decrease over the course of time. And if you are having symptoms of an active infection, then don't play. Don't kiss your partner. Don't engage in oral sex. You know, don't engage in penetration, what have you. So, you know,
most often they like the people who even have it in them, they have no symptoms at all.
Right.
Like if they test positive, they never have an outbreak. They never get anything. And I heard that's the majority of the people who have it, which is why everybody thinks they don't have it.
Yeah.
But they do.
Right. Well, and there are certain herpetic infections like herpetic Whitlow, for example. I had a child patient who had little herpes vesicles on her finger and she will test positive for herpes antibodies. I'm not going to test her for it because why? But that patient will test positive for herpes antibodies for the rest of her life, and she may never have an oral or genital outbreak. In fact, the fact that she has those antibodies from an infection on her finger might actually offer some protection against her getting an oral or genital outbreak from a partner at some point later in life. The same is true of herpetic infections that are on the skin of wrestlers. So this is a population of people who are like skin to skin contact, because herpes is skin to skin contact. A condom isn't going to protect you from herpes. I think that's like a myth that a lot of people believe because we have terrible sex education in this country. But wrestlers are at increased risk of herpetic infections because they're in skin to skin contact with, you know, their teammates and opponents, and they're in contact with the mats And so a wrestler who gets a herpetic infection on their skin will also test positive for antibodies for the rest of their life, despite the fact that they may never have an oral or genital outbreak.
Wow. See, I had no idea. So if a condom doesn't protect you, is that because there's still skin to skin? Regardless?
Exactly. Right. So same with HPV, same with monkeypox, right? Like the condom will protect you from an HPV lesion or an HSV lesion that's on the shaft of the penis that's covered by the condom. Or, you know, if you have the female condom, that it'll protect you for whatever that plastic is covering. But if someone has a herpetic lesion in the anal area, as we were talking about, or if they have an HPV lesion on the scrotum or beneath the scrotum or on the taint, like that skin-to-skin transmission is still going to be there despite the fact that people are using condoms. And this is why I'm
thank you for educating us.
The HPV vaccine.
I was going to say, you think by my age now, I would know some of this stuff. But yeah, back when I was young, we didn't use condoms because the AIDS outbreak wasn't until, 84, I believe. And before that, they would just tell you to go get on the pill. That's all they cared about. You know, if you were the girls, your mom would say, call the doctor, get on the pill. But they never told you to use a condom. So then it started coming with the AIDS thing. But that's probably why we don't know about it. But
we do a terrible job of teaching like STIs, sex education in this country. Like that's a whole other different soapbox and one that I'm very passionate about and I do a lot of reading about. I'm actually going to a conference next month, the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. And that conference is covering a lot of different things. It's covering hormones, it's covering postpartum, it's covering cancer, it's covering, you know, trans, like gender transition and hormone issues. It's covering how to take care of non-monogamous people and, you know, like kink. There's a workshop in this medical conference on breath play. And doctors are starting to learn this stuff. Yes, because it's like we weren't taught about it in school. We weren't taught it. Like I wasn't required to take a sex education class, even in college, even in medical school.
I did.
Yeah.
My teacher was a lesbian virgin.
Wow.
we would look at her like, how are we? You're teaching us. You've never even done it before. So that was always funny. And I was like, how does she know she's a lesbian? Because she didn't have sex yet.
Yeah. Sometimes I just, yeah.
And so, okay. So now that one of the latest things also is the PrEP and the doxy, right? And when I went to my physician, I asked her for the PrEP and she was like, okay, but I got to tell you, it could tear up your stomach quite a bit. And she said, they have a new drug that's out and it won't tear up your stomach, but it's only prescribed to men right now. Even though she said it didn't matter the genetics, like if it was male or female on how this medication worked. But she said, unfortunately, I can't prescribe it. I got to give you the one that'll hurt your stomach. So I've yet to try it because the thought of me having a sick or upset stomach when I'm filming is not a good idea. So,
right.
But then now they have... Is that what the doxy prep is? Is that the other version that doesn't hurt your stomach?
I'm going to go over two different okay. things. So
PrEP, I'm ready.
Pre-exposure prophylaxis. So PrEP is for the prevention of HIV. And it can, you're correct, it can cause GI upset. It usually is transitory and will go away after you've been on the drug for a little while. With PrEP, there's a monitoring process that goes into it. So we have to look at your kidney function. We have to look at your liver function. And we monitor that over the course of time. But there are programs in place because I think most insurance at this point, and which is a whole other different soapbox that I could get on about insurance companies, but most insurance will cover PrEP at this point, but there are organizations that make PrEP available for people who are uninsured and otherwise couldn't afford it. So those organizations are out there.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is for prevention of HIV for people who have been like sexually assaulted or, you know, have been exposed to a partner that they didn't know had HIV, but then they found out later. So you can also do post-exposure prophylaxis or PEP to prevent to decrease the likelihood that you will seroconvert into HIV positivity. So there are a couple of different ways to protect yourself from HIV. DoxyPEP, P-E-P, is different. So PEP is post-exposure prophylaxis. So it's like a morning after pill for gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis. Doxycycline is an antibiotic that's been around for decades. We use it to treat Lyme disease. We use it to treat some, you know, forms of pneumonia. Like I have patients who are on tetracyclines to manage their acne, right? Lower doses, but it's an antibiotic that's safe, it's effective, it's cheap. So there was a study that was done out of UC San Francisco. And the study was collected in men who have sex with men and trans girls. And what they did was they gave 200 milligrams of doxycycline to the study participants after an unprotected encounter. That's like receptive oral, receptive anal, penetrative oral or anal, 200 milligrams of doxycycline after an unprotected encounter. And they saw that in the study population, the likelihood of getting gonorrhea decreased by like 55 to 60%, and the likelihood of catching syphilis or chlamydia decreased by 80%. The data was so convincing that they called the study off early because it would have been unethical to continue not to treat the control arm of the population. So,
yes.
As a result of that, the San Francisco City Clinic and, you know, a variety of different public health organizations around the country are recommending doxycycline 200 milligrams after an unprotected encounter to decrease the likelihood that you'll get gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis. The issue with cis women was that there was one study done in Africa. I'm not sure what country it was done in, but the study showed non-efficacy in cis women. However, when the scientists went back and looked at the data and actually like did hair samples to see if the patients were taking the medication, the patients weren't taking the medication. So it was shown not to be efficacious, but it was not efficacious because the patients weren't taking the drug. So to extrapolate, basically the CDC took public comment on this issue up until like October or November, because the study is relatively recent. And the recommendation from the CDC is that DoxyPEP can be prescribed to cis women on a case-by-case basis. But again, a lot of doctors aren't up to date on this information, or they don't really understand the studies or haven't taken the time to read the guidelines. So from my standpoint, as someone who works with and is close to ladies in the industry, my recommendation would be, you know, you're at a high enough risk that this drug would be of benefit to you. To answer your question on the GI upset, yes, doxycycline is known to cause GI upset. And I've had some patients, I have a friend who won't take doxy because the GI symptoms are just intolerable. So I have this conversation with patients and let them know, like, this is a known side effect. It can kind of like wipe you out and make you feel like garbage. And I'll usually prescribe Zofran with it, so that if that happens, they're able to, and Zofran is an incredibly effective anti-nausea medication. Like, it will make you stop vomiting. It will make you stop being nauseous.
Right away. Yes.
So those two things.
But also, that's a one-time treatment then. It's not something you would take every single day, like the PrEP, correct?
Exactly. So DoxyPEP, you take on an as-needed basis. It's most effective if you take it within 72 hours of an unprotected encounter. It's not the kind of thing that I would want patients taking like multiple times a month, or, you know, after every unprotected encounter, if they're, you know, filming every week on a weekly basis. And, you know, like, we would need to have a separate conversation about that, because that's
as a PrEP. Yeah.
PrEP is daily ongoing medication. DoxyPEP is like a morning after pill for as needed use. Make sense?
No idea. This is great. Yeah, I'm just glad it's available, because that was going to be one of my questions. Like, if a condom breaks, mm-hmm. what should you do immediately?
Right. So my recommendation would be morning after pill, PEP to prevent HIV transmission, especially if you don't know the status of the person that you're with, and DoxyPEP to decrease the likelihood of gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, and then to get a full like testing panel 2 weeks after the encounter and then get tested again a month later. That would be my recommendation.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot now that we have to go through for, I mean, it used to be a lot more casual and mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, you know, one night stands and do that. And well, yeah. My other, I had one more question about that. I can't remember. I had so many. So where can they get this stuff? If say, if I needed, I had unprotected sex or something broke and I'm like, oh my gosh. And do you just call up the doc? Like, who do I call? How would I get a hold of that? If I say I didn't have insurance, because most of us don't.
Yeah. So the public health department, the Southern Nevada Health District is here in Las Vegas, but every major city and even rural outlying areas have health districts. So they're an excellent resource. There are commercial organizations. I know that HelloWisp.com is a commercial website that yes. you can order. You go on, you fill out some forms, a doctor kind of reviews your stuff, and you can get DoxyPEP that way. I know that one of my big complaints too is that there are a lot of like barriers to care for accessing doctors. Like I sort of have a niche market where my patients contact me directly, but like, I don't ask any questions when people are like, I think I have this, or I have a test that popped hot. Can you treat me? The answer to that question will always be yes, without question. And I'm starting to build, as a result of my sort of being like very face out talking about this stuff, I'm starting to build a network of physicians across the country who are very sex positive, who are advocates of sex workers, who are, you know, not going to judge people for being non-monogamous, for example, right? But there are, you know, public health resources available. I know the LGBTQ Center here in Las Vegas has like free, cheap, easily accessible testing and treatment, PrEP, DoxyPEP. And there are commercial organizations that you really just have to like Google DoxyPEP and then they'll come up.
You'll find it. Now, what are some things that people in the industry can do to lessen their chance of contracting something? Is there stuff that they, I mean, different, like, you know who you're filming with, or make sure it's a test that's within, you know, you're the first one on a test, or is there anything we can do to bring it down, you know, the risk?
So I think for industry folks, it's important to know who you're filming with, have that line of communication. And, you know, just as you showed up to a shoot with your test results, like expect that the people, this is your work, right? Just like OSHA protects us in hospitals and Jacob, like there's oversight. Make sure that you are talking with and filming with people whose status that you know. But at the end of the day, you're responsible for your own health. And sometimes things slip through the cracks. So my recommendations would be make sure your HPV vaccines are up to date. And some people think that they got the HPV vaccine series when they were a teenager, but then I pull up in the database and they're like, oh my God, I never got it. You know, and this is like cervical cancer and genital warts. So know your HPV vaccination status and how to access it. If you haven't been vaccinated against HPV, get it. And you can go to the local health district and get it. You may have to pay cash out of pocket for it if you are over 46 or if you don't have insurance, but most insurance will cover it if you're under 46 and insured.
Isn't there an age cutoff where they won't give it to you? Because I believe I was on that age. Like there's some age cutoff. I don't even know.
So this is another sort of like common issue. The maximum age from the standpoint of insurance companies for coverage is 46. A lot of people in their 40s don't know that. They think that because the cutoff used to be 26 and now it's 46. My doctor never even bothered to recommend the HPV vaccine for me, even knowing that I'm not monogamous and never have been. You know, like I had to seek that out and go and get it myself and pay cash out of pocket for it because my doctor didn't even bother to advise that I get it. You can get the vaccine if you're over 46. And I know female physicians in their late 40s and early 50s who have paid out of pocket to get it because it's not a safety issue after 46. It's a question of insurance won't pay for it. And they're pretty expensive. It's $350 per dose. And there's some question as to, you know, like most people have probably been exposed to HPV by the time they're 46 years old. Like most sexually active adults have been exposed to it. The issue is that there are over 150 different strains of HPV. And just because you had like HPV strain number 8 at one point in your life doesn't mean you can't get the high risk strains 16 and 18 or 6 and 11, which are the ones that cause cervical cancer and genital warts respectively. So my recommendation is get the HPV, like if you're a sexually active person, and I think everybody should be, I think, you know, with asexual people aside, like the world will be a better safer place if we were all having good sex, right? It's like, so
it's the weekend, I'm home alone.
Yeah. Like don't get a beer bottle. But yes, so you can get the HPV vaccine. It's just a matter of cost.
Just got to get it yourself. We have to pay for everything ourselves. Insurance covers nothing. None of our testing. We're just like, doesn't feel good when they do that to us.
Well, we can have a separate conversation about health savings accounts and how you can use pre-tax dollars to access healthcare through a health savings account, because there are loopholes that I've learned to navigate. Yes, that's another conversation. To circle back to what you ask, what can adult industry folks do to protect themselves? HPV vaccine, get on PrEP. I would advocate for anybody who is either in the adult industry or is playing with people in the adult industry, get on PrEP and consider
the daily, right?
Right, right.
That's the day. Okay.
Yeah, because I mean, HIV antiretroviral medications are going to wreak much more havoc on your body if you do end up getting HIV. And then you have to disclose illness, and you know, it's much better to just like prevent. So HPV vaccination, PrEP, DoxyPep, and birth control or an IUD.
Yeah. You know, that subject of pregnancy came up and I'm like, you're not on birth control? And I was thinking, and a lot of them more often than not are not. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, this is so bizarre to me. So I don't even know the statistic, or couldn't even take a guess at the mess that probably creates, but I'm not understand. Is it because it's not available to them, or does every story have a different reason?
Everybody has a different reason as to why they're not. And, you know, I have my own concerns about access to contraception and access to pregnancy termination for whatever reason the pregnant person chooses. I've talked to patients who, you know, had to go through like 14 different doctors in order to get a tubal ligation or a bilateral esophagectomy, like basically like to be sterilized as a woman without a child. You have to, like, there are a lot of doctors who won't do it. And so, yeah. And IUDs do hurt to insert. And I try to prepare my patients for that and make sure that they're properly medicated when they go in to get their IUDs. And a lot of women.
I've had the implant for like 16 years, maybe more. And whole new world.
I feel the same way about my IUD.
I love these. I mean, I'm like, this is the best ever. So that was a thing of the past a long time ago. Well, you have filled us in with so much good information that I was not aware of. Is there anything you want to add to this conversation that you think we should know?
So my question for you, as someone who has conversations with a lot of doctors and has a pretty extensive social network of clinicians that are kind of coming to me and asking me questions and are like endlessly curious about my conversations in this arena, if you were helping me to come up with programming for doctors, like, this is how you take care of sex workers, this is how you take care of folks in the industry, these are some sensitive conversations that you need to have, what types of things do you think I should be teaching doctors in order to advocate for this community?
This is a good one. I would have to say, I personally have a doctor that spends extra time with me, like extra, that goes above and beyond because of what I do, instead of shuffling me through. But I think opening the communication, gosh, I don't know how to make someone comfortable, but educating as you're having their exams and all that, be educating along the way is really important, because we really don't know what any of this means. You know, a doctor might go and do your annual, do this, and then you're out. You don't know any of this. They don't tell you what to look for, what to watch for. They just do their job and go. So I think that's the difference from my doctor. She really explains everything as she goes. And, you know, if you get an infection, she's like, that's because one penis belongs inside of you, not two at a time. And that's why it'll throw your pH off and stuff like that. So she's not afraid to just say it and lay it out there for me. And I'm like, oh, won't do that again. And so she sort of helps teach me, but it opened up the line of communication and just not being, I never felt like I was less than or dirty, or it really stayed professional. I just literally, like, I could tell her anything that I do, good or bad. And same with one of my friends. I mean, she does these crazy, like, cum walks and nut on her face and blow bangs. And she tells her doctor, and she's having, you know, some eye problems and a surgery. And then the doctor's like, now, no cum in your eye.
Yeah.
So I think it's just opening, you know, really knowing what they're actually doing. Like, what are they filming? Are you doing boy, girl, all that stuff? And then giving them resources that, you know, this is where you can go. I feel like, and mine's even through the health department, but I feel like I could go to her and for at any time, any day, and just call.
Yeah.
And I've had to.
That's so amazing. That's,
I think, education.
So much of my practice as someone who's sort of like outside of the system as such as it is, so much of my medical practice is relationship based, and my patients and my patients' parents, like, people trust me because I build these relationships. And you know, there are systemic issues related to the structure of the healthcare system being for profit that, you know, make it sort of this like cattle call, factory farming kind of medicine. And so I commend your physician for taking the time to get to know you and for not getting on a moral high horse or, you know, shaming you or anything like that, because, you know, we shouldn't be doing that with patients. And heaven knows it.
Now the ER will do that, but the emergency room, oh man, they're horrible. Horrible. Well, you know, you come in with a sore throat and they're like, and I'm like, well, it could be this and this and that. Well, you end up having like strep and, you know, strep throat, and you feel like you're going to die. And they're like, ah, she thinks she has sexually transmitted disease in her throat. I'm like, hold up. I'm just telling you what I do to. Yeah. So you think you have disease in your throat? He's like, dude, no, no.
I don't so like anyways. Getting care in the emergency department, even Even with a shattered femur, I didn't like being in the emergency department. I don't think anybody likes being there.
No, that was not fun. And then they're not as aware about those different categories for sure, because they've done some interesting things with some people that I knew, like swabbing a syphilis. They swabbed it instead of, and they're like, who swabbed it? And I'm like, oh, it was the ER, urgent care. And they're like, because they told them they didn't have it. Mm-hmm. They're like, you're not supposed to swab it.
Yeah. Well, it depends on so syphilis can cause a primary infection that is an ulcer. And in that case, like if there's an active ulcer, then that would warrant a swab.
Okay.
Because the ER is the least convenient place to get treatment for anything for sexually transmitted infections. The health district or an urgent care or a primary care doctor.
Urgent cares, yes.
An OBGYN, like anywhere but the ER. And I mean, unless there's like an assault, you know.
And that's what sucks is that most of us don't have insurance. So if you had an emergency that you needed to get some medical care, your option is to go to the ER.
Urgent care. I gotcha. Yep.
Yeah. Go to the health department because they have a center for disease control, right?
I haven't looked at all health districts across the country, but like my understanding is that every public health district has an office specifically dedicated to prevention and treatment of sexually transmitted infections. So
that's the local health district understood is as well.
And for queer folks, there are often nonprofit organizations in major cities that are dedicated to the care of, you know, the LGBTQ community. So if folks are more comfortable going there than the public health district, then that's an option too.
And then for people in the industry who want to get more information, is there an organization that you would gear them to, or do you just go to you?
So
want all the phone calls?
I can't take all the phone calls. I do have resources available on my website. Yes. So ArtemisLuxuryWellness.com is my website, and I do have some resources available there, but you know, the biggest bang for your buck is just going to be to Google the public health district or sexually transmitted infection clinic at your local health district.
All right. Well, this has been so educational. This is so needed. And you seen us start throwing questions at you left and right. And so many of us just don't know. So I think it's going to be a really good educational episode. And no, we are not the safest community out there. I'm like, we test all the time. We're the safest. And they're like, no. So yeah, a lot of myths have been debunked.
Yeah. Oh, and getting back to your previous question, I actually do have a YouTube video that's linked from my website that is Sex Ed Reboot. And it goes through all of what we just talked about, all of the different infections. It goes through the neurotransmitters involved in orgasm. And so there's fun stuff in there too, but it also talks about PEP and DoxyPEP, PrEP, HPV vaccination, all of the things, and it's on YouTube. And you can link that from my website, ArtemisLuxuryWellness.com.
Yay, and I'll put it down in the links in the description. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you, Lily. Thank you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of Phone Sex with Lily Show and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share with others. Post about it on social media. Simply type in Phone Sex with Lily Show. For the latest from Lily, you can follow her on Twitter at LilyCravenXXX or message on Facebook at Lily.Craven40. Thanks again. Until next time.